Thanks for joining me again on New Books in Military History. With me today is Brian Sandberg, who's a professor at Northern Illinois University outside of Chicago. And he's the author in 2010 of a book entitled Warrior Pursuits that covers the noble culture of combat in the early 17th century. So thank you for joining me today, Brian.
Oh, thanks for having me on, Jay.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this particular book?
Okay. Well, I'm a historian of early modern Europe and the Mediterranean, and I did my undergraduate work at the University of Texas at Austin, and there I took classes on a variety of subjects, but also war and society, and I became really fascinated with the history of early modern warfare, even though I was taking courses with a historian who was actually an Africanist. He did modern African history, but explored the deep past of African military history using oral history methods. So I became really interested in the earlier history of warfare. And then when it was time to head off to grad school, I went to University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And one of the reasons why I chose that program was because you had John Lynn there and also Jeffrey Parker at the time, who were both doing exciting work on early modern European military history. So it seemed like the right program for me. And I went off to grad school thinking in terms of working on the military history of the French Revolution. In particular, the Vendée Civil War, I found really fascinating because I found that civil conflicts were less treated outside of the American Civil War than international wars. So I was really interested in the Vendée Civil War, this conflict in the western part of France during the French Revolution, in which peasants and nobles, often who were Catholic, battled against the French Revolutionary forces. And it was a really bloody conflict. But once I got to University of Illinois and started taking classes with both Lynn and Parker, I really became very interested also in the military revolution, which was then a big debate in the early 90s, and became fascinated with the European wars of religion, which coincided with the arguments about the military revolution, and just got sucked back in time to the late 16th, early 17th century, where I found a lot of the same issues that I was already interested in: civil conflict, religion involved in warfare, religious warfare. And so I left behind the French Revolution and settled on studying the European wars of religion through the perspectives of the military revolution debate and what was being called at that time the new military history.
Right. One of the things I found fascinating about the book is precisely this focus on civil conflict, because it does allow you. I mean, the complexity of the social and the political, not only the political environment, which is there when you're talking about international war, but really the social environment as well, and the kind of local and regional focus that you get to really allows you to tease out some of these cultural elements that you're interested in looking at about people's relationships, ideas about war and conflict and religion, and it's really fruitful, I think.
Absolutely. And when I first started working on this project, I really saw it as a way of sort of testing out some of the theories about the military revolution concept. And I was intending to use methods primarily of social history in investigating this. But the further I got into the project, the more I found cultural methods to be more useful in understanding these civil conflicts. And the focus on the military revolution debate receded into the background. There's still some parts of the book that do respond to that military revolution debate, but I found much more interesting the dynamics of how nobles were involved in organizing all the warfare in this period. And another thing that surprised me was that all the literature on this period really deals with the rise of the state. This is the beginnings of absolutism, according to many histories of early modern France. And so when you look at warfare in this period, it's treated as a sort of an impediment to the rise of the absolutist state. And all the historiography was really focused on the relationship between Paris and the provinces, very court-centered, very government-centered. And instead I found all sorts of pervasive civil conflict going on out in the provinces, which was being either ignored by this state-centered literature or treated as sort of minor conflicts that were really irrelevant to the greater narrative of the rise of the state. And so the cultural history methods helped me find much more serious military conflict going on this regional level.
So you can't – I don't think you ever call it this and I'm your sources probably didn't lend themselves exactly to this kind of analysis, but it's almost the way the history of everyday life in a more contemporary context complicates, you know, stories about modernity or you know, these grand narratives that we tell ourselves, because you're able to get down and into the provinces in which you chose Languedoc and Guyenne for your study because of sources or
– Well, it's partly because of sources, but it's also because most of the conflict was going on in these regions. The most serious and most sustained civil conflict during the 1610s, 1620s into the early 1630s is really going on in these areas. So then the question became, well, why? Why are these particular regions so filled with conflict? What's going on there? How do we explain this? And the idea of a resistance of these local areas against a centralizing state had been trotted out by some historians back in the 1970s. And the more I got into the sources, I didn't find that convincing at all. Mm. And the role of the nobles became really key in understanding all this violence as I saw it. And there again, the notion of nobles within this narrative of the rise of the absolutist state became really key. Because nobles have been seen by many absolutist historians as being just impediments to the centralizing state. They are frivolous. They are focused on their own self-interests, but playing around in court culture. Any sort of serious military activity was not considered to be something related to the nobles. The absolutist historians were really going along with Norbert Elias's famous theory of a civilizing process, that the absolutist state was successful in taming the nobles, domesticating them during the 17th century. And this would end up, by the late 17th century, according to Norbert Elias, ending up with nobles who were just living at the court at Versailles, who were completely separated from any sort of bellicose activities, and gambling and having sex and doing other, frivolous activities at the court, as he saw it. What I found was that nobles were deeply engaged in warfare, and there was no sign of them giving up these activities. So something different had to be going on in the 17th century with the growth of the state. It wasn't a marginalization of the nobles, but somehow nobles changing the ways in which they were participating in warfare, certainly not disengaging from military activity.
So one of the things that you didn't mention specifically, but it's implied in your comments there, is that you really help put the lie to the notion of the nobles' economic lack of sophistication. In other words, you portray them in significant detail as being the masters of these complex economic engines on their estates, through trade, through wine, through olive oil, not just simply agricultural products either, but systems of credit and finance that were ultimately necessary to fund the kinds of warfare that they were practicing in.
Exactly. A lot of historians traditionally have portrayed nobles as the landed nobility. They see them as just on their estates. They're dealing with agricultural economies. They're dealing with their peasants as workers on those estates and see them only in those terms financially. Well, I found that nobles were very active, very mobile. They have multiple properties in this period. Many of them have residences in cities. They spend a lot of their time in cities. And as such, they're involved in lots of credit mechanisms in this period. They're raising loans. They're giving loans. They give loans to the state as well as to regional bodies, governmental bodies. And they also are capable of raising enough funds through a combination of different types of financial mechanisms to raise their own small armies in this period. And sometimes these are quite significant. You can talk about even armies of 10,000 men raised by individual powerful nobles at times. So this is quite significant when you talk about the waging of civil warfare, because civil warfare is often waged, at least in the early modern period, by a series of smaller field armies operating simultaneously. And if nobles can raise these forces themselves, they're not dependent on the state to raise taxes for them in order to authorize them to raise these forces. So it's a very dynamic form of civil conflict, in part because the nobles are capable of using all of these credit mechanisms, which involve both loans, but also economic relationships through the town, so merchant activity, their agrarian estates, too, are also contributing to this. And then appropriation of taxation, appropriation of money, pillage economy, all of this goes together to allow this sort of warfare to go on.
And the other aspect there is that for all that these conflicts may have been relatively small scale. I mean, you do mention several of them do snowball and become very significant in terms of the number of people involved. But most of them are small scale, but they're still very complex, involving sieges and raids and pitched battles and blockades and all kinds of different varieties of warfare.
Absolutely. I mean, there are often dozens of sieges going on simultaneously across southern France in this period. And you start to realize some of the patterns here when you look at which communities are being targeted and why. So nobles are not just, you know, randomly raising forces here. They're raising forces in order to promote certain politics and military aims here. And many of those coincide with religious factors. So you have southern France divided between Catholics and Calvinists in this period. And the further I got into the research, the more I started to realize that these two provinces are really the areas, when we're talking about Guienne and Languedoc here, these are the two provinces that have the highest percentages of Huguenot or French Calvinists in them. So this is really a continuation, as I see it, of the French Wars of Religion. The famous Edict of Nantes in 1598 did not really succeed in halting religious violence. Instead, this continues throughout the first three decades of the 17th century with localized warfare between Catholics and Calvinists, and often over control of access to communities. So a lot of these sieges are attempts to control the population and to control access to space for missionaries and preachers of either side of this religious divide. And these conflicts are very, very serious if you consider the implications for the ability to attempt to convert one side or another in this as a religious conflict, or at least religiously infused conflict.
One of the points that your book makes very well is the kind of political acumen that was required to master this situation for these nobles, because of the complexity of the context of civil conflict and involving religion and patronage networks and relationships with the royal state. You got the sense that these people had to be on their toes constantly, you know, managing finances, managing relationships, managing soldiers, and it was just an incredibly complex environment.
Absolutely. I think sometimes today we think of military officers as having an exclusive role. We think in terms of their rank, and we think in terms of certain duties that are attached to said rank. You can't really understand early modern warfare if you take this sort of modern notion of officership and just drop it down in the 17th century. Nobles are nobles first. This is part of their being. They conceive of nobility as dividing them off from the rest of society, the rest of 90% of society or more that are commoners. And So if they are involved in military activity, defining themselves as warriors, then they see that as an activity that they're engaged in. But it's not exclusive to their being. So they don't think of themselves as military officers, even though that's one role they play. They are also politicians. They also have titles, and they need to uphold their noble titles and their dignity. They also have lots of practical things that they have to engage in, even if they're acting as military commanders. They have to raise money continually, so they might have to leave their army or their troops for a time and head off to a city to handle credit problems. They also have to maintain their own properties, which are often far-flung. They might have to run off to the royal court to negotiate with other nobles or with the king, wherever they are. So you have to see nobles in this period not just as military officers then, but as warriors who are nobles and who are also engaged in all of these different activities, basically wearing multiple hats at the same time. So it makes it hard to pin down their motives when they're doing military operations, because military operations are always dovetailing with negotiations. And here again, there's a real disconnect between our modern notions of warfare often. We think of, following Clausewitz, that war is a continuation of politics by other means. We think of diplomacy as one aspect of politics, and then war is separate. It goes on in between these periods of politics. Not for the nobles in this period. They conduct diplomacy constantly within a civil conflict at the same time that they're conducting operations. And this helps explain some of the reasons why nobles are sometimes changing sides during civil conflicts, because the politics are continually changing. So it's very complex to get into this as a researcher and as a historian dealing with the archives here. Very hard to decipher the motivations of individual nobles as they are simultaneously waging war and negotiating.
One role that they play that you omitted in this discussion, but that you actually begin the book with, is their role as managers of a family.
Oh,
yeah. And really a lineage, so a family mm-hmm. across multiple generations. In some ways, that seemed to me like in their minds, their primary duty was to successfully manage the family, the notion of heirs and inheritance, and the maintenance of those, of the, as you said, maintenance of the concept of nobility mm-hmm. in that lineage over time. And that, it seemed like a lot of what they were doing, whether it was economic or military or in terms of political alliances, was aimed ultimately at preserving that that role for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I think that's fascinating about the ways in which the nobles are mobilizing their own family networks is that we often take families as a given. And very clearly, especially in a conflict that is civil in nature, you have divided families, of course. And many of the families in this period were divided not just by political differences or disputes over inheritance or disputes over property. Many families are actually divided religiously too. And there's lots of conversions that go on in this period too. So families are not stable during the French Wars of Religion. And so actually dealing with protecting a family's patrimony, organizing one's family as a military unit at times, which nobles definitely do, this is a problem for nobles to deal with. Rather than just a source of strength, they have to be active managers of the family networks if they're going to be successful at all. So I think you're right in pointing out that the family is very important to the nobles here. And the household, the notion of the noble household with the patriarch, male patriarch at the head of that household is very crucial. And many households are destroyed as effective family units during the fighting in these conflicts.
So I think also as a cultural history, you have important things to say about some of the ways in which this noble warrior class looked at the world in terms of honor. Honor in particular, I guess, mm-hmm. is the first thing that sort of pops out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is one of the notions that I was able to really develop using cultural history methods, was looking at a range of different what I call bonds of nobility, ways in which nobles were able to construct ideas of community in the provinces, and honor is one of the most important of these. But it's not, again, a given. Some historians have taken honor to be a sort of coherent concept. And early modern French nobles are often assumed to be doing everything on the basis of their motivations by honor. If you think of French nobles, often people think, first of all, of the Three Musketeers by Alexandre Dumas, the film versions of it. And they think of nobles as duelists, first and foremost. And certainly many French nobles indeed engaged in dueling in this period. What's been forgotten is that that's really a small part of their engagement with violence. Their activities in civil warfare really dwarf their engagement in dueling, even though dueling culture is certainly part of the violence in this period. So honor, rather than being a sort of simplistic motor for interpersonal violence, I find to be a really complex and multi-layered concept, which can both fuel conflict within noble culture, but they can also provide a sense of community for nobles, a sense of brotherhood even for male nobles who are engaged in civil conflict. So I look at several different ways in which honor culture operates, and it has dimensions that relate to the notions of dignity and quality, the noble's position within the hierarchy of noble culture, but also to their religious activity. So a notion of sanctity is there, but it can be very competitive, a notion of precedence. And every time that nobles find themselves together, whether that's on the battlefield or at a church service or an entry into a town, they are put into order for their entry into that space, whether it's riding on horseback, the position of their units on the battlefield, or their place of seating in the church. These are all ordered based on precedence. So they have constant competitions over this sort of precedence, and this does relate to the civil conflict too, not just to dueling, which some other historians had already recognized.
Yeah, I think that the focus on dueling is another aspect, like the notion of the sort of simplistic landed aristocracy, the notion of a simple economy. Breaking apart that notion of dueling also clarifies or alerts us to the complexity and the seriousness of warfare, right? So if you imagine people as just duelists, that's a way of saying they're not serious warriors. They just play at this, right? But you get down into the details and show us the seriousness of these conflicts.
Absolutely. And I think it hasn't really been recognized fully yet. And I didn't really have the time in this study to develop this particular point further, but I think that a lot of the dueling in this particular period is very closely connected to the civil conflict, so that you have political rivals, military rivals, often dueling when they get opportunities to do so. Many of those opportunities occur during the brief moments of peace. You have a series of truces and peaces during this period, and those allow opportunities for nobles to socialize across, the different boundaries of their military organizations. And I should add at this point that, one of the things that's really fascinating about the civil conflict in this period is that you have some warfare going on every year in this period. The armies are not permanent, though. So one of the things that goes on is in these brief moments of peace, well, the armies are demobilized. Almost every winter, field armies are demobilized. Not all the troops go home, but many of them do. And then every spring, you have a reignition of some sort of conflict at some point during the year, often early in the year. And across southern France, then, you have forces that start to remobilize. So there's this constant pattern of mobilization, demobilization going on. It's never complete. But when you have partial demobilization is going on, then nobles start to socialize across the bounds. They're no longer fighting at those moments. And those moments of socialization also are very dangerous. That's where you can have some of these dueling opportunities break out, especially when nobles are congregating in cities together. So a very war-filled period here. A very violent period, and so dueling could help highlight even further the civil conflict if somebody wanted to go through and try to research those duels systematically.
So I think that's one of the opportunities that your focus on civil conflict creates is the that there isn't such a stark distinction between war and peace, that you can maintain a focus on military aspects and military culture across a significant span of time because you don't have a clear kind of demarcation that you – I mean, obviously this is not true in all cases, but that you might have more frequently in international conflicts where there's a start and an end.
Absolutely. And I'm not the only historian to see the French Wars of Religion as being these long conflicts, but there's several historians now along with myself who really see 1598 not as the end point of the French Wars of Religion, but instead see them stretching all the way to 1629 or even a little bit after that. So if you take that longer term view of the French Wars of Religion is stretching from around 1562 to 1629, then you can see that there are many pieces. Some of them are briefly effective for 6 months or even a year. Most of them are relatively ineffective, more like truces, and then they break down again. There are also lots of localized truces that will come into play for a brief period of time and then break down. So if you can see all of this period is involving low-level civil conflict in regions across France, then you can really look at the intersections of war and peace as being a constant here.
Mm-hmm. So one of the central concepts that that you discuss in the book is this idea of the culture of revolt that existed among these nobles. And I'll ask you to elaborate on that a little bit, but maybe also clear up a question that probably arises more from my ignorance than any failure of your book, and that is, how is it possible for a Catholic noble to revolt? And in the sense that, in this conflict, isn't it always – it seems like it ought to always be the Calvinists who are identified as the rebels who are, in opposition to the Catholic king.
That's a really good question. I think that what I'm trying to get at with the idea of a cultural revolt is the notion that revolt is a way of doing religious politics in this period. And the notion of a describing it as a culture of revolt is a subtle way of responding to another historian's way of looking at revolt in the early modern period in France. And this is the famous historian Arlette Juana, who is not translated very much into English. And so certainly French historians know her work very well, but a lot of other early modern historians don't know her work. But she describes a duty to revolt. She sees early modern French nobles as doing politics in response to the state. She sees French nobles as motivated to revolt when there are times of threat to the notion of a mixed monarchy. Basically, the idea of the French Constitution in this period, as they talked about it, was that the king would rule through consultation with the nobles. And so she sees this notion of a constitutional duty as being the major reason why nobles will engage in revolts throughout the 16th century and 17th century. I find it to be less of this sort of constitutional duty that's motivating nobles, and much more localized religious politics. So in this sense, even Catholic nobles can be motivated to go into revolt or to take up arms, which is the way in which they talk about revolt. To take up arms for a cause is what they consider revolt to be. So when Catholic nobles take up arms, they do so because they see that the king or the king's ministers are not being tough enough on Calvinists within their society. Many of the hardline Catholics see Calvinists as heretics in this period, and certainly Calvinists also see Catholics as heretics in the period. So there are a lot of real steep tensions here. But it's possible for either militant Catholics or militant Calvinists to raise arms in order to pursue their religious political goals, and to do so through armed revolt. When they do revolt, though, they don't see themselves as in revolt against the king. They always claim to be doing something else. They're in revolt against the king's ministers. That's a classic sort of excuse in early modern French society. But they can also claim to be defending their church, or defending religious orders for the Catholic nobles. This is very important. They see themselves as defending the Jesuits and the Capuchin, the other monks and friars who are active in trying to convert Calvinists in this area. And so that can be a reason for them to revolt. So there are a number of different reasons then that nobles can articulate as motives for their taking up of arms in this period. So the cultural revolt concept tries to then unpack, well, how do they actually justify the taking up of arms? How do they mobilize forces? And then how do they form armies and actually try to carry out military operations in order to pursue those goals?
So rather than being the concept of a duty to revolt, identifies it as a kind of defense of aristocratic liberty against the royal state. Again, with this notion of an encroaching absolutist state. Whereas seeing it as a culture of revolt and looking at that context in which the state just becomes one element that's manipulated to further a particular cause, again, kind of complicates this notion of a kind of absolutism and the the kind of weakness of aristocracy mm-hmm. In the face of that advance.
Exactly, and even though my book does not have an operational history within it, I tried to pay particular attention to what was going on with the military operations here. I think the military operations reveal what some of the nobles' motivations are. They certainly published pamphlets, justifying their action. They wrote letters to the king, to the ministers, to other nobles, justifying their actions too. So, I mean, I try to dissect, what they say there too. But if you look at their targets of their military campaigns, which cities and towns do they besiege? Which other nobles do they go after? How do they pursue military operations within the civil wars that are going on? I think that this helps reveal that their aims are not to try to preserve a sense of the Constitution or to to oppose the centralizing state. It's instead trying to control local politics and local religious sites. And they do this through their military operations. So that's a way in which I think that the operational military history can be very, very useful if you look at it through cultural history methods, because even operational history is great at revealing the motives of commanders who are the ones, of course, directing these operations.
Well, that's an excellent point. And I wouldn't play down too much, I wouldn't play up too much the relative lack of real operational history, say, because you do tell us a great deal about the nature of armies, how they're recruited, how they're financed, how they travel, lots of really great details that might be considered, a contribution to operational history for increasing our understanding of that.
I appreciate that. I just meant that in terms of dealing with that operational history, rather than trying to go through and do a narrative of the military operations so that one could understand year by year exactly what operations were going on, I took a thematic approach in this book and tried to expose some of the patterns that emerged from those operations, even though the operations themselves are fascinating.
Right. More kind of case studies and episodes mm-hmm. that illustrate your points.
Yeah, exactly.
I was struck by one of the insights you have about the siege warfare in that particular context, and how fraught it could be, and the fact that it was, in fact, they tended to be speedy operations because you never knew from which direction the next attack was going to come, where relief might come from, because you're in a sea of conflicting loyalties and conflicting military groups.
Yeah, this for me was absolutely fascinating because I think a lot of the literature on civil conflict in English language, and especially published here in the United States, has been really colored by the experience of the American Civil War, which is in many ways not a typical civil war. I mean, the notion of a sectional conflict, and I know that there are some fuzzy edges around the Confederacy in the American Civil War, but nonetheless, the American Civil War being this sectional conflict is very, very different from most civil wars, which have interpenetrations of different populations. So in southern France in the early modern period, many Catholics and Calvinists were living within the same communities. You had divided communities. Other communities would be more solidly Catholic or more solidly, Protestant, but often nearby each other. So you have sort of Swiss cheese effect across the south of France, where you have all these different population groups that are Catholic and Calvinist in very close proximity to each other. So anytime there's any sort of outbreak of violence, even urban violence, nobles starts to mobilize. And as soon as one noble starts to mobilize, well, other nobles nearby start to mobilize. And you have this security problem where everyone feels at risk. And so nobles are using their own chateau and also their urban homes as bases of operation for raising funds, raising troops, putting out small armies, and then they start to coordinate politically with other nobles around them and combine into ever larger units and field armies. And operations can often commence within 24 hours of mobilization. So you're talking about very rapid mobilization, very rapid military activity here. And so sieges then become really key at controlling the space, controlling strategic sites, controlling the regional space here, controlling the major highways that you have through southern France. And so you have some sieges which are very hasty operations where you have assaults to take cities or small towns or chateaux, and then other sieges, especially of major cities, take much longer. A lot of this has to do also with how well the communities are fortified. And this is a period for those listeners who might be familiar with the Military Revolution. This is a period in which the bastioned fortification is spreading throughout Europe, been developed in the early 16th century, but now was very widespread. And so a lot of the communities that were sizable communities in the south of France used bastion fortifications in this period, some of them permanent, some of them hasty fortifications. But when you have sieges of those communities, sometimes they can last much longer, example being the siege of Montauban in 1621 or the siege of Montpellier in 1622. These are some of the bigger sieges of the period in this region. Of course, the most famous siege in this period is outside of the regions that I deal with. That's the siege of La Rochelle in 1627-28. But these sieges are very important for the nobles because they're sites where they can socialize, they can do their politics, and they can also gain control of key strategic sites and population centers.
Well, and what one connection that I made when you were discussing those kinds of sieges is this notion of not just socialize, but be observed being brave. Right. Mm-hmm. I think of one book that I use in class is John Lendon's or J.E. Lendon's Soldiers and Ghosts, which is about ancient Greece and Rome.
Okay.
And the importance among the Greeks military culture of actually not just being brave, but being observed being brave. Mm-hmm. And that then in some ways their formations and their practices of war were influenced by the need to be observed in these contexts. And you make that point, I think, with relation to those sieges, that the nobles need to be out there being seen in the front lines and doing what they're supposed to do.
Absolutely. And some other French historians have pointed out the nobles need to be observed, but they've often focused on the monarchs observation of the nobles. Seeing this as part of the growth of the absolute state, some have even referred to this as sort of royal surveillance. And you know, I don't deny that there's some role for that. But you can see nobles, if you look at the sources, look at what they write in this period, both in terms of their manuscript and their printed sources in this period. Nobles write about what other nobles are doing. So when a noble successfully pulls off a siege, or when a noble makes an attack and is seen as very heroic at a siege, launches an assault on a particular redoubt or something that that succeeds gloriously. This is talked about and often at length. I mean, for months, nobles will be talking about this, sometimes even longer than that. So sieges become real important opportunities for nobles to observe each other, and over a long period of time. They're socializing with each other in the camps, but they're also observing each other on, the field of combat there. In that way, sieges can be more useful than battles, because battles, right, it's very hard to see what everybody is doing. Sieges are more orchestrated. They take more time. You have certain particular assaults. If they stretch for a couple of months, you have a series of different feint attacks and approach trench operations, as well as the big assaults. And this makes them very useful to nobles who are wanting to display their honor, display their courage, and this can enhance their political and military power too. Because one of the things that nobles do, especially powerful nobles in this period, is they attract a lot of followers. And this is one of the things that actually got me into this whole study in the first place, was looking at how patronage clientage networks really work in this period. And nobles are able to attract other nobles as their clients, part of their entourage, in part by their military reputation. So their displays of courage and also of military command at sieges are really crucial for them to attract more nobles to their entourages, become part of their loose-knit clientels.
So I think that's a great example of the way this book, uses cultural history in a way that is still down to earth. It doesn't go, launch into kind of abstract theorizing or notion, Foucauldian notions of power relationships, but kind of really demonstrates in concrete ways and in concrete interactions how culture, how ways of looking at the world, ways of thinking about what's important, really influence events on the ground.
Mm-hmm. No, I appreciate that. And certainly Michel Foucault is very fascinating to read. And I think a lot of his insights can be very useful for military historians. But I was more attracted to one of his very interested readers and critics, Michel de Certeau, who's one of the he's actually a historian by training. But he became very much a theorist, cultural theorist. And Michel de Certeau is known as one of the theorists of practice. So he actually critiques Michel Foucault at the level of his notion of disciplining.
Right.
And Foucault really saw discourses as informing culture. So you had these sort of intellectual structures that would determine how people act. Michel de Certeau, on the other hand, looks at the practices of everyday life and tries to see how ordinary people on the ground are able to flaunt the sort of rules of society that Foucault would see as determining how cultural activity works. And so Certeau, I thought, was very useful for looking at people like the nobles I was studying, because the French state at this time, the monarchy, is certainly powerful, and there certainly is a notion of cultural norms that it's trying to set in and around Paris. But I found that nobles are able to very much construct their own notions of culture by borrowing some of what they see as important from the royal court, but also doing other things in their own way in these regions. And so in that sense, this cultural history of practice developed by Michel de Certeau and other cultural theorists became really useful for me in approaching the sources on warfare in this period. It allowed me to have a way of thinking through what these nobles were doing that did not obey the sort of standard line of the historiography on absolutism and the centralizing state, which also really saw the construction of the royal army going on, depending on Richelieu, beginning in exactly the period that I'm studying. I sort of downplay that in part by using this this cultural theory to understand what the nobles are doing.
Well, this makes me curious what you're working on now then. What's the next piece going to be?
Well, I have a book I'm trying to finish up right now, which is it's sort of a sequel to Warrior Pursuits. When I first started Warrior Pursuits, since I was conditioned by the historiography I've been describing, this absolutist historiography, I expected to find that the nobles were indeed very self-interested and not dealing with larger causes. They were just sort of resisting the centralizing state. But I wanted to figure out, well, how were they doing that? And the further I got into it, the more I discovered that religion was really important to understanding what was going on. And I managed to work in a lot of the religious aspects into Warrior Pursuits. But there are many other dynamics of religious violence going on in this period. So what I do in the new project is I focus on religious violence and sectarian conflict in the same period. And look at how the dynamics of religious conflict are really shaping the period. So where the first book, Warrior Pursuits, focuses on the nobles' involvement in civil warfare and sort of the mechanisms of waging civil war, the second book really focuses on the dynamics of religious warfare. It highlights the relationship between religion and military activity, and that has really not been heavily studied for the early modern period, or I would argue it at all. Military historians have unfortunately ignored or largely ignored religious motives, religious forms of violence that in certain periods are very important in understanding warfare going on. And so that's what I'm trying to do in the second project, is look at the period after the Edict of Nantes as a real continuation of the French Wars of Religion, and then inquire, well, how can we look at religious violence as being a central part of warfare in this particular period?
Sure, and when you have notions of heresy involved, there's bound to be a complicated relationship to violence there.
Oh, definitely.
Are there witch hunts and things like that are going on at the same time, or
there are some witch hunts in this period, but that is really pretty marginal compared with the amount of religious warfare going on. Yeah. And one of the things I try to do in this new project is look at intersections between religious warfare and other forms of religious violence. People have looked at religious violence like crowd riots, for example, in a city environment, or who have looked at iconoclasm, often separate those out. They see this as sort of movements of social violence, whether it's peasants or urban workers who are doing the violence, or clergy who are involved in it. They see religious violence as not really being religious warfare, but instead as a sort of social movement that can turn violent. And in doing the work on Warrior Pursuits, I found a lot of material that shows that the nobles, but also the townspeople in this period, are very involved in not just fighting the civil wars, but in promoting religious violence, and that includes outright religious warfare. So this book tries to really deal with that in a complex way, and it's very, very difficult to do that because the period is so chaotic, and also there are not so many great models for how one integrates religious history and military history.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. We'll look forward to that. One thing I like to ask authors as well is what else they're reading, or what else might we look at in, you know, a recent book in that would relate to military history that other people would find valuable. Because I think you know, the idea of this podcast is to expose people to serious scholarly works. And one thing that you do when you're engaging in this kind of scholarship is you develop these networks, right? And so that each author I interview is plugged into a quite a different network usually, and leads us in different directions, which I find fascinating. So you can sidestep the question if you're not prepared, or beg for more time. But is there something recent that you found especially interesting and thought-provoking?
Sure. I'm actually teaching a class periodically at Northern Illinois University on religious violence in comparative perspective. And this sort of supports the current work that I'm doing in my own research. And it's absolutely fascinating. I deal with religious violence from around 1500 right up to the present. And so what I try to do is look at studies of the European wars of religion and then compare them with later periods of religious violence, including religious violence in Iraq and Afghanistan today. So just a couple of the books that I use in that course I think would be really interesting for anyone interested in religious violence. One of them is called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. This is written by Andrew Cunningham and Ole Peter Grell. And it's a study of the European wars of religion through the lens of apocalypse. And it's interesting for people who are curious about the 30 Years' War, or the English Civil Wars, as well as the French Wars of Religion, Dutch Revolt. That's a really fascinating book. I also use in that course a book that's about the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre called Beneath the Cross. And although that's very much focused on an urban massacre, its author, Barbara Diefendorf, does, I think, nicely point out how the early stages of the French Wars of Religion were affecting the politics and the development of violence within the French capital of Paris. Another one that I find really fascinating is by Mark Jurgensmeyer, who's actually a historical sociologist. He has a book called Terror in the Mind of God, which is a comparative study of religiously motivated violence and terrorism in the contemporary period. So Al-Qaeda is one of his case studies there, but then he also looks at anti-abortion bombings in the United States. He looks at violence going on in Palestine and other areas around the world today. So that it's an interesting contrast to look at some of these works at dealing with the European wars of religion and more recent studies of religious violence today. And One of the interesting things about these contemporary studies like Mark Jurgensmeyer's or R. Scott Appleby, who deal with religious violence today, many of them actually draw on a lot of the insights from the European Wars of Religion, and they cite the literature from the French Wars of Religion and the 30 Years' War as they try to analyze today's religious violence around the world.
It strikes me that oftentimes, you know, the way people talk about Islam today is in terms of a kind of what I want to say is an ontological model where well, Christianity went through these things hundreds of years ago with schisms and but we eventually kind of figured it out, how to live with each other and be nice, and Sunnis and Shiites will figure that out eventually. So some of it strikes me as kind of simplistic, but it sounds like these books really make some fruitful comparisons.
Absolutely. And realize that this notion that somehow the West is beyond religious violence, this stems precisely from the period I study in Warrior Pursuits. The notion of the Edict of Nantes as an edict of toleration that ended the French Wars of Religion is exactly what I'm critiquing in that book and in my current work. So the notion that Europe has somehow, or the West has somehow gotten away from problems of religious violence, I think is misguided. One of the things that Mark Jurgensmeyer is able to show is that civil violence during the civil rights movement back in the 1960s, as well as 1980s, 1990s violence over issues like abortion involved religious violence. There are ways in which one can see connections between the motives, the religious motives for violence, and a number of extremist groups in the United States, in Western Europe today, in Eastern Europe too, for that matter. So once you throw out the narrative that would say that the West is somehow beyond religious violence completely, then you start to see lots of interesting intersections. And there are ways in which one can analyze religiously motivated groups' violent activities, regardless of religion. Islam is not the only violent religion somehow. Christians can be very violent. Buddhists can be violent, something that a lot of people don't want to explore. But members of any religious community can be violent. The question is how, when, and why then? And so looking at these comparative contexts, I think, is a good way of getting out of the sort of conventional historiographical trends, which would lead us to accept assumptions like Islam is somehow violent and the West has gotten beyond any notion of religious violence.
Right. Peace of Westphalia tops off the Edict of Nantes and we've got mm-hmm. it all figured out.
Right. Exactly.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm sure listeners enjoyed listening to you talk about your book.
Oh, well, thanks for the opportunity to come on the show and to talk about Warrior Pursuits. This was a lot of fun.